We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
I'm Kamitawi. An empty shell. That is how Iran's top security official has described the JCPOA. Does this mean that the fate of the JCPOA revival talks is in danger? Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether the parties to the deal, the U.S. and its European partners, can give Iran the guarantees that it is looking for. We will also look at why Israel showed up at the Vienna talks and which party felt the need for it to be present there. Let's first get an update about the talks that are going on, the revival, JCPOA revival talks that are going on in Vienna. Of course, one of Homa Jeleski joins us from there. If we have Homa, can you please tell us what the latest is regarding the JCPOA revival talks?
Yes, Kaveh. We just had a tweet by the Russian lead delegate, Mikhail Ulyanov, and he said that consultations are continuing, intensive discussions almost non-stop, as of course we are reaching, as everyone is saying, the final stages of these negotiations. It looks like it's a make or break situation now. Earlier, the Chinese lead delegate also addressed reporters today, and he said, in his words, this is the last stage of the talks and we are a step away from a final agreement. And he said that he's pleased to say that the sides are taking steps towards each other, meaning the positions that have been expressed, saying that both Iran has come with constructive initiatives on the table following the political decisions that it's already made. And he said that the Europeans and the Americans have also come up with some efforts, and he believes that they are taking steps towards each other, and that the next 1 or 2 days, he said, are going to be quite crucial. We also had earlier, as we said, remarks by the French foreign minister addressed to the Senate, where he said that the onus is now on Iran, that Iran has to make the decision. At the same time, Iranian officials have made it clear that they have already come up with their initiatives. They have already taken the steps necessary. They're not going to go beyond the JCPOA. And now, if the United States particularly makes the decisions, when it comes to guarantees on sanctions removal, verified sanctions removal, and the removal of all of the Trump-era sanctions, including entities and people, individuals who've been sanctioned under the Trump administration for various other reasons that are not directly JCPOA-related, then this is not going to work. And also guarantees the U.S. is not going to withdraw. And at this stage, however, all sides are still saying that a deal is within reach. We'll have to see if that is going to happen. Kaveh.
Indeed. Thank you so much for that. Homa Jeleski there from Vienna. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Fouad Izzadi, university professor and political analyst, joins us from the capital of Tehran. Also joining us is Daniel Lazar, journalist and author, who joins us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome to you both. And Fouad Izzadi, let me first start with you and get an idea from you Our reporter from Vienna, Homolesky, used this American saying, make or break. So what do you think will make this work? What do you think will break it?
Well, the breaking part is easier to do. The United States is in the business of breaking things in general, bombing things and occupying places. And they can do that by continuing the failed policies of the Trump administration, as they have done in the last year since they have been in office. If they continue these maximum pressure tactics that Trump used, the talks are going to fail. That's one option they have. The other option they have is get rid of this addiction to sanctions. The sanctions are not going to cause the overthrow of the Iranian government. Sanctions are not going to cause Iranians to give more concessions to the other side. Sanctions are going to hurt ordinary Iranian citizens, and that's it, which is not a good thing to do. And what the United States needs to do is to decide whether they want to continue the failed policies of the past or realize previous mistakes and correct previous mistakes. If they lift sanctions, if they return to their commitments under JCPOA, then you can have an agreement. If they talk about a longer and stronger document, if they want to change the text of JCPOA, if they want to find ways of going around their commitments, then the Iranian side is going to be more careful this time. There's this American saying that you fooled me once, shame on you. If you fooled me twice, shame on me. And the Iranians are not going to be fooled twice by the same group.
Indeed. Well, I'm at a loss of words for the third American saying, Daniel Lazar. But Daniel Lazar, you've been obviously following these revival talks, the JCPOA revival talks in Vienna for quite some time. And obviously you're familiar with the news, but we're really at what stage right now? What are we looking at? We're seeing right now in terms of perhaps Iran saying, listen, this ball is in your court. I know some of these statements, some of these stances may sound repetitive, but they're not, because there's been a lot of negotiations taking place. Where do you think we're at right now?
Well, it's very hard to tell because, you know, we're viewing things from the outside. And so we really have no idea what's actually going on inside the negotiating room. But I must say that I have been very skeptical from the very beginning about the success of these talks, and I still am. I think that the mood in the U.S. Makes a U.S. compromise all but impossible. Congress is adamant, extremely hostile to Iran. Nationalism is growing. America is in a very bellicose mood, especially since Afghanistan, the disastrous pullout in August, and even more since the Ukraine crisis. So America is in no mood to compromise, and so therefore I am very skeptical about any chance of these talks ending successfully.
Well, let's talk about the skepticism, but in another way, if we can, Fuadizadeh, and that's from the Iranian side, because if anything, they are the ones that need to not only maintain their skepticism because of what has happened before, but they need the guarantees. But are they going to get them? We're talking about the guarantees first and foremost, I think, for the U.S. Next administration to adhere to this deal, let alone the ones that are needed in order for this to even work. What are we looking at from that vantage point of the Iranians on that?
Well, we are looking at Washington that's in chaos. We have the Republican Congress people that are totally opposed to any agreement with Iran. They like to continue the maximum pressure campaign. And then we have some Democrats like Robert Menendez, who is the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in the U.S. Senate. He talked about Iran for about an hour last week. And one of the demands that he made was that P5 plus one countries, he's asking them to used a snapback mechanism to bring back all sanctions against Iran. And he's a Democrat. He opposed JCPOA last time in 2015. We have Chuck Schumer, who also opposed JCPOA and did not vote for it. He is the majority leader in the U.S. Senate. He was not the majority leader in 2015. He is now. So you have opposition among Democrats inside the U.S. Congress. And if the U.S. returns to the agreement and has the capacity to use the snapback sanction, I don't think next time Robert Menendez will ask P5+1 countries to use the snapback mechanism. He will pass a law to do that. And they may have enough vote to actually overcome a presidential veto if Biden decides to veto that. So there are lots of complications in Washington. The United States is designed in that manner. And generally, when there is disagreement between the U.S. Congress and the administration, many times, generally, the U.S. Congress wins because of different reasons. So we have to be very careful with what Robert Malley, the U.S. representative in Vienna, is saying, because we don't know if he's actually representing the United States government as an entity. The U.S. government is divided on these issues, even within the Biden administration. You had people like Richard Nephew leaving the negotiating team because of what he said, disagreements with the direction. So there's a lot of complications, and that leads the Iranian negotiating team to be much more cautious when it comes to believing what the U.S. side is saying.
And that's exactly Daniel Lazar, what Iran has said. I'm sorry about that, Fudazadi. I thought you were done. I apologize. But to follow that train of thought, Daniel Lazar, Iran has said that there's divisions within the U.S. And, of course, as Fudazadi said there, the two lawmakers there, Chuck Schumer and Bob Menendez, and, of course, you had the 34 lawmakers led by Senator Ted Cruz. Who is it that's making – well, let me say it this way. Is the team in Vienna that's talking indirectly with Iran representative of what will happen, or – is the one in Washington and the lawmakers there the ones that are going to decide, or is there a split?
Well, both sides. I mean, the negotiators in Vienna are there in behalf of the executive branch, the presidency, and the lawmakers are part of the legislative branch, obviously. But the lawmakers, though, do have the power to block any kind of agreement. But also, more importantly, you have to bear in mind that the anti-Iran sentiment, pro-Israeli sentiment is very, very strong in the U.S. The Democrats, for example, are no better than the Republicans in this regard. In fact, in some ways, they actually may be worse. So I just don't see any kind of political support for a successful conclusion to these negotiations. I think that any attempt by the Biden administration to compromise, to eliminate sanctions, would lead to a storm of opposition in Washington. I don't think that it would survive that reaction. So I think I'm just, as I said before, to reiterate, I am extremely pessimistic regarding these talks.
Fudazadi, we know that the voice of Israel on this, which many consider noise, has been going on for quite some time. But it was somewhat of a shock in a sense. And I'd like to find out from you what you thought when the news came out that there were Israeli diplomats that were in Vienna on the sidelines of these JCPOA revival talks. An Israeli delegation, some called it. I'm curious as to, first of all, what you think of it, but whether they were invited or they just decided to hop on a plane and go to Vienna. What did you think of that?
You know, I think we are getting near the talks. I don't think the talks will continue much longer. And it's a decision time for the other side to decide what to do. And obviously, the Israelis want to influence that decision. That's why they flew to Vienna. They have been flying to Washington also, and they have been lobbying with other members of P5 plus one to actually get what they want, which is causing more difficulties for people in Iran. And
what do you think, if I may jump in there, why do you think they chose to meet with Rafael Grossi and Russia's representative? Why those two?
Well, they need to talk to Mr. Grossi because they want to use the International Atomic Energy Agency to put pressure on Iran. And Russians have been helpful in the last number of months, and they want to reduce the effectiveness of the Russian delegation in actually helping other parties to reach an agreement. So they realize that Russians have been influential, and they want to also cause difficulty with that. And we have Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, that is visiting Israel today and fully supporting anti-Iran policies of Israel, and stating again that they're going to be in one front against Iran. Mm. So when we see that, when we see the latest resolution by Bob Menendez and Senator Graham, Lindsey Graham, about the idea of Iran not enriching any uranium inside the country, and then they say that even if Iran accepts that, they want to continue sanctions on Iran for other reasons. And they also, in that resolution, call for the U.S. Congress to approve whatever agreement the executive branch of the United States makes in Vienna. So we have all these data points that make people in Tehran much more cautious with regard to what the other side is actually doing.
I've never understood, maybe Daniel Lazar, you can enlighten us as to why Israel really is so much against this. I mean, we know some of the reasons, obviously, but when you take a look at what this JCPOA revival talks will do, in essence, it is something that obviously Iran will fall in line with what the JCPOA was. And Israel should be somewhat satisfied about that, but yet it has gone out of its way, obviously, to try to derail the talks, for lack of a better word. My question to you here is that this delegation was an Israeli foreign ministry official, and you also had the Israeli regime's envoy to the IAEA there. How can he be telling the IAEA, when Israel has nuclear warheads and is not an MPT member, of what to do here?
Yeah, it's quite bizarre. It's quite arrogant. You're quite right. But Israel's attitude towards Iran is one of maximum hostility. Israel sees Iran as its chief enemy in the Middle East, and therefore it wants to do whatever it can to hurt, harm, retard, isolate the Iranian state. And therefore, it uses all its influence in Washington to persuade the U.S. to do the same. And Israel's has been very effective, but America is very hostile to Iran on its own account. Listen, Americans don't know anything about Iran, nothing at all. They can barely find it on the map. But one thing every American knows is the 1979-80 embassy takeover. I guarantee you of that. Those memories are still fresh. They will be fresh for years to come. And that is ultimately the source of the great hostility in the U.S. towards Iran.
Well, I'm guessing, Fouad Azadi, that one thing that Americans also can't forget, especially the Treasury Department, is how ineffective the sanctions have been. And I'm going to come in here with a tweet of which Ali Shamkhani said, the Supreme National Security Council director, "It is not possible to promise to lift the sanction that has become ineffective in order to score a point." So I'm sure the American side knows that. Why are they continuing with their sanction regime?
Well, they don't know any other thing. It seems that U.S. foreign policy is just sanctions and sanctions and sanctions, even when they don't achieve foreign policy goals. The U.S. Foreign policy has become one-dimensional, creating hostility and then sanctioning the other side. That's the basic formula. And the difficulty that exists is that when you continue this sanctions policy, sooner or later that policy will fail, as Mr. Shamkhani mentioned today, that Iran selling a lot of oil as we speak and getting the money back. So the other side promising lifting of sanctions when the sanctions have become ineffective is not going to be very attractive, given the fact that the other side in Washington is clueless with regard to what they want to do with the Iran policy and all the disagreements that they have. Another important piece of news today, I think, was Iran's foreign minister interview with the Financial Times, requiring the U.S. Congress to have a vote on the nuclear talks. I think that's very important. Before Iran reaches an agreement, we need to know what the U.S. Congress thinks about the agreement, because we realize that they have the power to influence the direction that the U.S. executive branch takes. And if the U.S. Congress is represented by people like Bob Menendez or Lindsey Graham, then we realize that whatever Robert Malley tells the Iranian delegation in Vienna is not really going to be implemented. And last time, the U.S. stayed in the nuclear agreement for about 2.5 years. This time, given what we have been talking about, I'm not sure if they managed to stay in the nuclear agreement for 2.5 months. And that's the cause of concern, and that's why you see Iranian officials are becoming quite doubtful about the value of the nuclear agreement.
Well, one of the things that has resulted, Daniel Lazar, over the course of time that's been expanding is the scope of Iran's gravitation towards the East. And in particular, we could talk about, obviously, number one, China, and then Russia along with that. The trade bloc, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, another example where Iran joined, and just the expansion of these trade relations, which brings about this sanctions-proof shield for Iran, making sanctions ineffective. The U.S. realizes that, I am sure. So therefore, shouldn't that be a factor in the decision-making for the U.S.?
Well, it should be a factor, of course, but it's not. I mean, America is in a very bad situation. From 1989 until 2001, or even later, it was the great unipolar moment for America. America ruled the world. Its word was law. Its power was overwhelming. Really, it was in a position that no other imperial power had ever attained before. And now politicians are desperate to get back to the recapture that golden moment. And that is Biden's mission. Biden's slogan is America is back, and that he wants to turn the clock back to that golden age. So whereas it would make sense for the U.S. to compromise with Iran, if only to sort of calm down one theater of operations.
Sure. I got to unfortunately jump in, and I'm sorry about that. Gifuat Azadi, just 30 seconds that we have left in time. Fuad Azadi, in closing, your statements, please.
You know, I think your other guest in New York was getting to the right point that he was making. I think he was making a very important statement that President Biden is not Obama, and John Kerry is not around. We have Tony Blinken, and people make a difference. And the goal of the current administration is something different from what we saw before, and you're going to see the result that's going to be different.
Thank you very much for that. I do apologize for cutting you off there, Daniel Lazar. Unfortunately, again, we're fresh out of time. Fouad Izadi there, university professor and political analyst. Thank you for your contribution. Daniel Lazar, pleasure, journalist and author from New York. And that does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikava Tahve and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned.
من روا على مؤمن رواية يريد بها شينه.
It is very much emphasized in Islam not to be curious in the lives of others or to find fault with them. This can be in the real or virtual lives of the people. The example are violating the privacy of the people or recording and filming the private information of the people. These deeds are absolutely rejected in Islam, up to an extent that a judge cannot base his arbitration on such secret details.
اینها نمیتونه منشأ حکم باشه ورود به زندگی خصوصی
Entering the private life of people both in real world and on social media is a sin and is considered haram. We are not allowed to search about the lives of people, even their children. Of course, sometimes there is a threat to a family or a country. In that case, the intelligence services are allowed to do some secret missions. However, the people are not allowed to break into the lives of people and search about them or disclose their secrets to others. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
British Muslim victims of a government-backed anti-Islamist crackdown on Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham have issued fresh demands for justice after a new investigation revealed that the government may have acted against them based on bogus extremism threat claims. A podcast series published by the New York Times titled The Trojan Horse Affair alleges that numerous players, including Government Minister Michael Gove, penalized several schools and their staff, despite knowing the accusations weren't credible.
Knowing all of these facts and background, he went on to launch an offensive against our schools and brought down what were, you know, highly successful schools within a matter of months. This was a clear abuse of authority and abuse of power, for which I think that people should be held to account.
The Trojan Horse affair began in 2014 after a mysterious letter was sent anonymously to Birmingham Council. The letter outlined a supposed plot by Muslim extremists to infiltrate, take over and radicalize schools. On the back of the letter, inquiries were launched, followed by an Islamophobic media frenzy, which then led to several Muslim teachers being sacked or banned from their work.
What we observed, and we witnessed this firsthand, was institutional racism, institutional corruption, and institutional Islamophobia. The media had a social responsibility to ensure that there was a balance and a reporting of facts, but this was not the case.
The Muslims targeted say they are victims of a state-backed witch hunt and that the extremism accusations were devastating.
I was unable to get any job. I was even refused voluntary posts. People wouldn't even accept my voluntary work because my name and personality had been stigmatized. I've been vilified, and the label of extremism and radicalism had been attached to my name. So it made me unemployable, quite frankly.
I would also say to Michael Gove, damages and compensation are due, and my ban and the ban of my fellow colleagues need to be lifted immediately.
After spending the day here in Birmingham, it's very clear that the negative effects that the Trojan Horse affair has had on the Muslim community still resonates very strongly. And with the victims' hunger for justice as strong now as it's ever been, the question is, what will be done to hold those who did any wrongdoing during the affair to account going forward? Robert Carter, Birmingham.
Sadhika, a 12th grade student in New Delhi, is outraged. She says it could perhaps be the first time in Indian history a particular community is being targeted for what they wear. Earlier, it would be our mosques, what we eat, our marriages, our personal laws. Now it's what we wear.
Being an Indian, we are very proud to be here. And we feel like every human being has a right to decide they have their own choice. We don't need to interfere between their choices. And the Constitution also gives us right there like that.
Last week, a video circulating on social media became a sensation within a few hours. A young college student from the southern Indian state of Karnataka was heckled by a group of saffron-clad Hindu students chanting slogans hailing Hindu deity Rama. The girl responded back with a similar reaction, chanting Allah Akbar, which means God is great. The incident blazed the public sentiments, with many calling the girl lioness, while others hailed her an Iron Lady. As India's state elections are underway, experts say polarizing the voters is a common phenomenon in India, with religion being the easy tool.
All effort is to try to erase Muslims from public places and to prevent them from being seen in public and impose apartheid on Muslim women. They are trying to achieve that target, but it's not as easy as they are thinking.
Another college student who spoke on the condition of anonymity said the ruling BJP might rewrite the constitution, considering their policies and actions they are imposing in a country.
It's the personal choice of a person to wear whatever they want to do, and according to constitution, we have the rights. It's totally a sad thing, and it's really like particularly targeting a particular community due to which we start living in a threat.
Ban on Islamic handscarves has outraged the Muslim community, saying it's an outright attack on their faith, which the constitution guarantees to safeguard. They say it could perhaps be an attempt to prevent Muslim women from attaining education or to flare communal tensions amid elections. Observers say anti-Muslim rhetoric has flared aggressively since BJP formed the government in 2014. They say since 2014, most of the elections in India were overly polarized. Religious divide has been the main triumph card of the current administration. Based on rights groups, the ruling BJP has adopted various laws and policies that legitimize violence and targeting religious minorities. Experts say it's a larger political agenda to make India a supremacist Hindu nation. Meanwhile, protesting student groups have defended the use of hijab, saying the constitution guarantees them religious freedom. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
People from all walks of life held a rally Monday in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza to support Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. They protested Tel Aviv's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners, especially those held under administrative detention. The event is part of a week-long national campaign in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners. This, as Palestinian prisoners observed a one-day hunger strike on Monday in all Israeli prisons.
We are here to send a message of solidarity to administrative detainees and to all the prisoners. We will not let the prisoners down, and we will spare no effort to release them. We also call on all international agencies to stop Israeli crimes against Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners suffer from inhumane treatment inside Israeli jails and are denied basic rights. Last month alone, Israeli regime forces arrested 504 Palestinians, including 50 children.
We are here to call on Palestinian resistance factions to support the prisoners and exert pressure on the Zionist regime to release them. Our enemy doesn't want peace and only understands the language of force and the language of armed resistance.
Rights activists say Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world turns a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
Administrative detainees are currently boycotting Israeli courts because their detention is illegal. They are being held under secret evidence under inhumane conditions. Administrative detention is an Israeli policy to make prisoners suffer.
Palestinian administrative detainees are being held without charge or trial, while their incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely.
Currently, the Israeli regime keeps more than 500 Palestinian prisoners under administrative detention, including women and minors. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran's major performing arts event,
Fajr International Theatre Festival wrapped up with an award ceremony on Tuesday. During the 40th edition of the annual event, theatre ensembles from Iran and the world took to the stage to perform plays. And the best performances are now honored here.
It's important that we as young actors are evaluated by the jury. This gives us a stronger motivation to continue to make progress. I thank the organizers of the Fajr Theatre Festival.
I was awarded for Best Playwright and Direction in the Radio Theatre category. This is my second Fajr Award. My first experience at Fajr was at the age of 24.
Theatre is the mother of cinema. Look at the great names in cinema industry. They have all started out as stage actors and actresses. So, Fajr Theatre Festival plays an important role in boosting and promoting this important art.
Theater troops from Afghanistan, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Iraq, Italy, France, Algeria, and several other countries have been performing in the 40th edition of Fajr Festival. Out of a total of 100 plays, 20 are themed with the 1980s Iran-Iraq War, and three others are on the endeavors of health workers during the pandemic. Stage actors believe Fajr Festival provides a platform for the audience to get acquainted with the performing art of different nations.
The festival was a big stage for troops from many parts of the world. It's so interesting for us as actors to see our fellow actors from other nations perform. It also helps us learn about their culture and literature.
Every year in February, Iran organizes Fajr Theater Festival on the anniversary of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Last year, the festival was held with no international participation due to COVID restrictions. And this year, the hosting halls have restricted their capacities to 30% amid the emergence of the Omicron variant. The 40th Fajr Theater Festival rolled down its curtain, with some winning a prize and others not. However, stage actors here say, aside from the competitive side of the event, it was a chance to learn about and enjoy the performances of other nations. And that's where the universality of the language of art comes into play. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The meeting between Vladimir Putin and Olaf Scholz was the first since Scholz's appointment as the German chancellor. During the talks, Putin called Germany one of Russia's main partners. The leaders touched upon the issue of Russia's proposals for security guarantees. The Russian president stressed that Moscow cannot turn a blind eye to how freely the United States and NATO interpret the principles of the indivisibility of security, noting that the expansion of the North Atlantic Alliance to the East continues, despite the assurances of Western partners.
About the expansion of NATO, here you said a wonderful phrase. They say that Ukraine will not be in NATO in the coming years. What does they say mean? You and I must understand what is spoken in interstate relations. We have been told for 30 years that there will be no NATO expansion at all, not one inch towards the Russian borders. And today we see the NATO infrastructure right at our house.
Putin added the postponement of Ukraine's entry into the bloc will not change anything, and Moscow would like to resolve this issue now. Speaking about the escalation in Ukraine, the Russian leader called what is happening in the Donbas a genocide. On February 9th, Olaf Scholz noted that Germany is ready for dialogue with Russia at all levels and in all possible formats for the sake of a political settlement. At the same time, he stressed that Moscow should not underestimate the cohesion and determination of Germany's NATO allies.
As for the situation with the negotiations, the positions differ, but it's important that we talk to each other. The proposals that were formulated by Russia, we also do not agree with them. NATO and the EU do not agree, but they also contain points that we are ready to talk about and are ready to discuss. Now it is necessary that a dangerous situation does not arise.
The German chancellor noted that positions of the West and Russia on security guarantees diverge, but the issue of Ukraine's membership in NATO is not on the agenda. This is while statements that Russia is preparing to invade Ukraine continue to come from the West, an allegation vehemently denied by Moscow.
Germany, as an important member of NATO, could influence its partners in the bloc, who, judging by their actions, are set up for a conflict with Russia. Moscow is not satisfied with semitones and ambiguities in matters of security guarantees. Their clear fixation is necessary. Only thanks to this it is possible to achieve a diffusion of tension, which is in the interests of Germany, located in the center of Europe. Marina Kartonova, Moscow.
Another bloody day has been witnessed in the occupied West Bank, this time in Jenin. 17-year-old Palestinian teen Mohammed Abu Salah was killed in the village of Silat al-Harithiyah as Israeli troops raided the town on Sunday night to demolish the home of Palestinian prisoner Mahmoud Jaradat. Dozens of Palestinians were injured by live ammunition and rubber bullets fired by the Israeli forces towards the protesters who rushed to the area to prevent the demolition. Mahmoud Jaradat is a prisoner accused of carrying out shooting last December that led to the killing of an Israeli settler near the illegal settlement of Homish.
What my dad did is a heroic act. It's a very sad and painful feeling to see our home destroyed, but we don't want to show the Israelis that we are sad. We can rebuild the home.
The Israeli forces raided the village and immediately opened fire at the protesters because youths gathered to protest the demolition. A number of them were wounded and one was killed while defending Jaradat's home. And after a few hours, the Israeli soldiers blew up the house with dynamite.
Tension continues to remain high for the third consecutive day in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. Clashes have been breaking out between Palestinian residents of the neighborhood and Israeli settlers and soldiers. Paramedics say over 30 Palestinians have been injured. A dozen others were also detained. The clashes came shortly after Israeli far-right Knesset member Itamar Ben-Gavir announced that he would be setting up an office in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood to protect the settlers. Ben-Gavir had erected a tent in the front yard of Salem family home, another family in Sheikh Jarrah facing imminent expulsion.
The Israeli extremist Knesset member is leading a campaign to allow settlers to take over Palestinian homes in Sheikh Jarrah. The Israeli regime is giving him full support, while Palestinians are defending their presence in Sheikh Jarrah and resisting the Israeli project to wipe out their existence.
Several Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah face potential eviction by settler organizations, all following last year's tensions and the May war between the Israeli regime and armed groups in the Gaza Strip. Observers today warned that Israel's continued aggression against Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood and its escalating violence across the occupied territories could be the spark that sets the entire region ablaze. Because at the end of the day, Palestinians say they will remain steadfast and Tel Aviv's violence will not stop them from defending their rights. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
As Bahrainis are marking the 11th anniversary of the February 14th uprising against the ruling Al-Khalifa regime, Bahraini rights activists in Iran are calling on their people to stay steadfast in their struggle against the regime's unjust policies.
We will never give up and we will continue our fight for freedom and for the constitution that our nation can write that with his hand, with his people who are free and they would like to be free forever.
Since February 2011, Bahrain has been the scene of pro-democracy protests by Bahrainis who complain about discrimination in the Persian Gulf Kingdom. The Bahraini regime has since been clamping down on any sign of dissent and has imprisoned and executed a large number of protesters. In a televised speech aired from Iran's city of Qom, Bahrain's prominent Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Qassem, called for the establishment of a democratic and constitutional system to replace the Al-Khalifa dynasty. Activists here also slammed Al-Khalifa for normalizing its ties with Israel, saying the move shows that the regime has no respect for the ideology of its people. The Bahraini rights activists say Al-Khalifa and Al-Saud are the puppets of Israel and the U.S., serving their interests in the region.
Bahrain is entering a critical stage and is turning into another Palestine. Israel is increasing its influence on the subordinate Al-Khalifa regime and is seeking to build military bases in Bahrain. This is a serious threat to the entire region, including Iran.
Bahraini activists argue that without Israeli and American support, the autocratic regimes in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia would collapse in a few days.
Political activists here say Al Khalifa's brutal crackdown on dissent is a proof of their illegitimacy to rule the country. They say the revolution will not subside until the Bahraini royal family relinquish power, on the grounds that it does not represent the majority of Bahrainis. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Liz Truss has gone from political also-ran to holding one of the highest offices of state in the UK, the country's representative to the globe. Promoted by Boris Johnson from International Trade Secretary to Foreign Secretary, with the additional job of solving the Brexit standoff with the EU, as well as pushing through with the talks in Vienna on the revival of the JCPOA, Truss has only been an MP since 2010. Whilst her in-tray may be overflowing, reports reveal the behind-the-scenes briefing Truss has had, this to gauge support as she fights a silent battle with Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. He's seen by many as her main rival for the Prime Minister's position should Johnson quit or be ousted. Truss's shift from staunch Remainer to ardent Brexiteer via a Margaret Thatcher-style makeover has not convinced everyone of her Iron Lady credentials.
I think Liz Truss is regarded by a lot of backbenchers as being quite lightweight. I think there's possibly a bit of sexism in that, but although the Conservative Party has had two women leaders, unlike Labour, I think we've also seen Liz Truss last week in Moscow really banging the war drums, trying to show how tough she was in regards to the whole Ukraine-Russia question. And I think part of that was to please Tory backbenchers.
It's a short walk from the Foreign Office to Downing Street, a fact that would not be lost on Liz Truss and her advisers. It's also a short political step from one of the senior offices of state to the top job. Just ask Boris Johnson, who was Foreign Secretary, before replacing Theresa May as Prime Minister. For a politician with such an important diplomatic brief, scandal has followed Truss with question marks about her judgment. Highlights or lowlifes include racking up thousands on expenses whilst on a three-day trip to Japan, claims of cronyism and using the expensive members-only club owned by a Tory donor during her stint as trade minister.
It doesn't seem to be held against anyone in the Conservative Party. We've seen lots of this around the test and trace thing at the beginning of the pandemic. We've seen a Boris Johnson's flat. We've seen all sorts of stuff around this, and it doesn't seem to ever come back in anyone. So I don't think that's going to bother most Conservative MPs and most Conservative members.
It seems Liz Truss's major selling point is not her intellectual gravitas or political track record. In fact, the opposition points out she did not actually finalise a single new deal that the UK did not have with the EU as trade minister, but rather she's the anti-Sunak, a flip-flopping ideologue who is not an ethnic minority. For some Conservatives, that may just be enough. Amina Taylor, London.
Millions of US dollars have been approved recently by the Israeli regime as part of a plan to connect illegal settlements in occupied East Al-Quds with those built in West the Holy City. This was revealed by Israeli media days after the regime's foreign minister Yair Lapid stated that Israel won't build a new settlement that will impede a future two-state solution, but only settler homes will be built in existing settlements across the occupied territories. Settlement watchdog groups said such statements are meant to deceive the world as settlement activity goes on behind the scenes.
What Lapid is saying is just like playing with the words, but it's so clear and obvious that what's happening in Jerusalem is an ethnic cleansing that's going on and Judaizing the city itself. When they are talking about linking the settlements and the outposts in and around Jerusalem with the real way to connect it with West Jerusalem, just to make it a surrounding of West Jerusalem, and dumping the whole Palestinian communities in East Jerusalem.
Israel's Finance Committee has approved a plan worth $310 million US dollars in order to link settlements in West Al-Quds with the other settlements in East Al-Quds, where the majority of its residents are Palestinians. The plan also includes expansion of the light rail, roads and infrastructure construction that would be only serving the settlers. Palestinians say this plan will further undermine the feasibility of East Al-Quds as the capital of the future state. Tel Aviv has done everything possible to minimize the Palestinian population in the Holy City and in Area C that constitutes about 60% of the occupied West Bank. Experts say what Israel is doing is annexation of Palestinian lands without official declaration. Observers say that Israel is moving ahead with settlement construction and is erecting new roads to only serve settlers, while at the same time, the occupying regime is squeezing Palestinians out of their land, their ancestors' land, to make their dream of an independent state impossible. Mona Kandil, in front of the illegal settlement of Pesigot, occupied Ramallah.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his